Chalon's Sketchbook, Kolinar Spren. The pain spren in Kolinar are a sickly green color, with long claws and oddly distorted proportions, even more than usual. They respond to pain as readily as ever. Shame spren have transformed from their usual manifestations as falling blossoms to shards of broken glass. The sense of embarrassment itself appears unaffected. Curiously, the hunger spren appear to be unchanged. 67. Mishim. This generation has had only one bondsmith, and some blame the divisions among us upon this fact. The true problem is far deeper. I believe that honor himself is changing. From Drawer 2418, Smokestone. A day after being murdered in a brutal fashion, Chalon found that she was feeling much better. The sense of oppression had left her, and even her horror seemed distant. What lingered was that single glimpse she'd seen in the mirror, a glimmer of the unmaid's presence beyond the plane of the reflection. The mirrors in the tailor's shop didn't show such proclivities. She had checked every one. Just in case, she'd given a drawing of the thing she'd seen to the others and warned them to watch. Today she strolled into the little kitchen which was beside the rear workroom. Adolin ate flat bread and curry, while King Elokar sat at the room's table, earnestly writing something? No, he was drawing. Chalon rested fond fingers on Adolin's shoulder and enjoyed his grin in response. Then she rounded to peek over the king's shoulder. He was doing a map of the city, with the palace and the Oathgate platform. It wasn't half bad. "Anyone seen the bridgeman?" Elokar asked. "Here," Kaladin said, strolling in from the workroom. Yokska, her husband, and her maid were out shopping for more food, using spheres that Elokar had provided. Food was apparently still for sale in the city, if you had the spheres to pay. "I," Elokar said, "have devised a plan for how to proceed in this city." Chalon shared a look with Adolin, who shrugged. "What do you suggest, Your Majesty?" "Thanks to the Lightweaver's excellent reconnaissance," the king said, "it is evident my wife is being held captive by her own guards." "We don't know that for certain, Your Majesty," Kaladin said. "It sounded like the queen has succumbed to whatever is affecting the guards." "Either way, she is in need of rescue," Elokar said. "Either we must sneak into the palace for her and little Gavinor, or we must rally a military force to help us capture the location by strength of arms." He tapped his map of the city with his pen. "The Oathgate, however, remains our priority. Brightness Tavar, I want you to investigate this cult of moments. Find out how they're using the Oathgate platform." Yokska had confirmed that each night, some members of the cult set a blazing fire on top of the platform. They guarded the place all hours of the day. "If you could join whatever ritual or event they are performing," the king said, "you would be within feet of the Oathgate. You could transport the entire plateau to Urethiru and let our armies there deal with the cult. In case that is not viable, Adolin and I, in the guise of important light eyes from the Shattered Plains, shall contact the light-eyed houses in the city who maintain private guard forces. We shall gather their support, perhaps revealing our true identities, and put together an army for assaulting the palace if needed."
"And me?" Kaladin asked. "I don't like the sound of this Azure person. See what you can find out about him and his wall guard."
Kaladin nodded, then grunted.
"It's a good plan, Elokar," Adolin said. "Nice work."
A simple compliment probably should not have made a king beam like it did. Elokar even drew a glory spren, and notably it didn't seem different from ordinary ones.
"But there is something we have to face," Adolin continued. "Have you listened to the list of charges that Ardent, the one who got executed, made against the queen?"
I...
Yes. 10 glyphs, Adolin said, denouncing Aesudan's excess. Wasting food while people starved, increasing taxes, then throwing lavish parties for her Ardens. Elokar, this started long before the Everstorm.
We can
ask her, the king said. Once she is safe. Something must have been wrong. Aesudan was always proud and always ambitious, but never gluttonous. He eyed Adolin. I know that Yasna says I shouldn't have married her, that Aesudan was too hungry for power. Yasna never understood. I needed Aesudan, someone with strength. He took a deep breath, then stood up. We mustn't waste time. The plan. Do you agree with it?
I like it, Shallan said.
Kaladin nodded.
It's too general, but it's at least a line of attack. Additionally, we need to trace the grain in the city. Yokska says the Light Eyes provide it, but she also says the palace stores are closed.
You think someone has a soulcaster? Adolin asked.
I think this city has too many secrets, Kaladin said. Adolin and I shall ask the Light Eyes and see if they know,
Elokar said, then looked to Shallan.
The Cult of Moments?
I'll get on it, she said. I need a new coat, anyway.
She slipped out of the building again as Vale. She wore the trousers and her coat, though that now had a hole in the back. Ishna had been able to wash the blood off, but Vale still wanted to replace it. For now, she covered the hole with a light weaving. Vale sauntered down the street and found herself feeling increasingly confident. Back in Urethiru, she'd still been struggling to get her coat on straight, so to speak. She winced as she thought of her trips through the bars, making a fool of herself. You didn't need to prove how much you could drink in order to look tough, but that was the sort of thing you couldn't learn without wearing the coat, living in it. She turned toward the market, where she hoped to get a feel for Kolinar's people. She needed to know how they thought before she could begin to understand how the Cult of Moments had come to be, and therefore how to infiltrate it. This market was very different from those at Urethiru, or the night markets of Carbranth. First off, this one was obviously ancient. These worn, weathered shops felt like they'd been here for the first desolation. These were stones smoothed by the touch of a million fingers, or indented by the press of thousands of passing feet. Awnings bleached by the progression of day after day. The street was wide and not crowded. Some stalls were empty, and the remaining merchants didn't shout at her as she passed. These seemed effects of the smothered sensation everyone felt. The feeling of a city besieged. Yokska served only men, and Vale wouldn't have wanted to reveal herself to the woman anyway. So she stopped at a clothier and tried on some new coats. She chatted with the woman who ran the accounts, her husband was the actual tailor, and got some suggestions on where to look for a coat matching her current one, then stepped back out onto the street. Soldiers in light blue patrolled here, the glyphs on their uniforms proclaiming them to be of House Velilant. Yokska had described their Bright Lord as a minor player in the city until so many Light Eyes had vanished into the palace. Vale shivered, remembering the line of corpses. Adolin and Elokar were fairly certain those were the remnants of a distant Kolin and his attendants, a man named Kavies, who had often tried to gain power in the city. Neither were sad to see him go, but it whispered of a continuing mystery. More than 30 people had gone to meet with the queen, many more powerful than Kavies. What had happened to them? She passed an assortment of vendors peddling the usual range of necessities and curiosities, from ceramics to dining wares to fine knives. It was nice to see that here the soldiers had imposed some semblance of order. Perhaps rather than fixating on the closed stalls, Vale should have appreciated how many were still open. The third clothing shop finally had a coat she liked,
of the same style as her old one, white and long, past her knees. She paid to have it taken in, then casually asked the seamstress about the city's grain. The answers led her one street over to a grain station. It had formerly been a Thalen bank, with the words "Secure Keeps" across the top in Thalen and the women's script. The proprietors had long ago fled. Moneylenders seemed to have a sixth sense for impending danger, the way some animals could sense a storm hours before it arrived. The soldiers in light blue had appropriated it, and the vaults now protected precious grain. People waited in line outside, and at the front, soldiers doled out enough lavis for one day's flatbread and gruel. It was a good sign, if a distinct and terrible reminder of the city's situation. She would have applauded Velalant's kindness, save for his soldiers' blatant incompetence. They shouted at everyone to stay in line, but didn't do anything to enforce the order. They did have a scribe watching to make sure nobody got in line twice, but they didn't exclude people who were obviously too well-to-do to need the handout. Vale glanced around the market and noted people watching from the crannies and hollows of abandoned stalls. The poor and unwanted, those destitute beyond even the refugees. Tattered clothing, dirty faces. They watched, like spren drawn by a powerful emotion. Vale settled down on a low wall beside a drainage trough. A boy huddled nearby, watching the line with hungry eyes. One of his arms ended in a twisted, unusable hand. Three fingers, mere nubs. The other two, crooked. She fished in her trouser pocket. Shallan didn't carry food, but Vale knew the importance of having something to chew on. She could have sworn she'd tucked something in while getting ready. There it was. A meat stick. Soul cast, but flavored with sugar. Not quite large enough to be a sausage. She bit off an end, then wagged the rest toward the urchin. The boy sized her up, probably trying to determine her angle. Finally, he crept over and took the offering, quickly stuffing the whole thing into his mouth. He waited, eyeing her to see if she had more. "Why don't you get in line?" Vale asked.
"They got rules. Gotta be a certain age. And if you're too poor, they shove you out of the line."
"For what reason?" The boy shrugged.
"Don't need one, I guess. They say you've already been through, except you haven't."
"Many of those people, they're servants from wealthy homes, aren't they?" The urchin nodded. Storming light eyes, Vale thought as she watched. Some of the poor were shoved out of line for one infraction or another, as the urchin had claimed. The others waited patiently, as it was their job. They'd been sent by wealthy homes to collect food. Many bore the lean, strong look of house guards, though they didn't wear uniforms. Storms. Velalant's men really had no idea how to do this. "Or maybe they know exactly what they're doing," she thought. "And Velalant is just keeping the local light eyes happy and ready to support his rule, should the winds turn his way." It made Vale sick. She fished out a second meat stick for the urchin, then started to ask him how far Velalant's influence reached, but the kid was gone in a heartbeat. The grain distribution ended, and a lot of unhappy people called out in despair. The soldiers said they'd do another handout in the evening and counseled people to line up and wait. Then the bank closed its doors. But where did Velalant get the food? Vale rose and continued through the market, passing pools of anger spren. Some looked like the normal pools of blood. Others were more like tar, pitch black. When the bubbles in these popped, they showed a burning red within, like embers. Those vanished as people settled down to wait, and exhaustion spren appeared instead. Her optimism about the market evaporated. She passed crowds milling about, looking lost, and read depression in people's eyes. Why try to pretend life could go on? They were doomed. The Voidbringers were going to rip this city apart, if they didn't simply let everyone starve. Someone needed to do something. Vale needed to do something. Infiltrating the cult of moments suddenly seemed too abstract. Couldn't she do something directly for these poor people? Except, she hadn't even been able to save her own family. She had no idea what Moraes had done with her brothers, and she refused to think about them. How would she save an entire city? She shouldered through the crowd, seeking freedom, suddenly feeling trapped. She needed out. What was that sound? Shallan pulled up short, turning. Hearing. Storms. It couldn't be. Could it? She drifted toward the sound. That voice.
You say that, my dear man, it proclaimed. But everyone thinks they know the moons. How could they not? We live beneath their gaze each night. We've known them longer than our friends, our wives, our children. And yet...
Shallan pushed through the milling crowd to find him sitting on the low wall around a storm cistern. A metal brazier burned before him, emitting thin lines of smoke that twisted in the wind. He was dressed, strangely, in a soldier's uniform, Sadius's livery, with the coat unbuttoned and a colored scarf around his neck. The Traveler. The one they called the King's Wit. Angular features. A sharp nose. Hair that was stark black. He was here.
There are still stories to tell.
Wit leaped to his feet. Few people were paying attention. To them, he was just another busker.
Everyone knows that Mishim is the cleverest of the three moons. Though her sister and brother are content to reign in the sky, gracing the lands below with their light, Mishim is always looking for a chance to escape her duty.
Wit tossed something into the brazier, producing a bright green puff of smoke, the color of Mishim, the third and slowest of the moons.
This story takes place during the days of Tsa, Wit continued, the grandest queen of Natanatan before that kingdom's fall. Blessed with grand poise and beauty, the Natan people were famous across all of Roshar. Why, if you'd lived back then, you'd have viewed the East as a place of great culture, not an empty wasteland. Queen Tsa, as you've doubtless heard, was an architect. She designed high towers for her city, built to reach ever upward, grasping toward the sky. One night, Tsa rested in her greatest tower, enjoying the view. So it was that Mishim, that clever moon, happened to pass in the sky close by. It was a night when the moons were large, and these, everyone knows, are nights when the moons pay special attention to the actions of mortals. Great Queen, Mishim called. You build such fine towers in your grand city. I enjoy viewing them each night as I pass.
Wit dropped powder into the brazier, this time in clumps that caused two lines of smoke, one white, one green, to stream upward. Shallan stepped forward, watching the smoke curl. The market goers slowed and began to gather.
Now, Wit said, thrusting his hands into the smoke lines, twisting them so that the smoke swirled and contorted, giving the sense of a green moon spinning in the center. Queen Tsa was hardly ignorant of Mishim's crafty ways. The Natans were never fond of Mishim, but rather revered the great gnomon. Still, one does not ignore a moon. Thank you, great celestial one, Tsa called. Our engineers labor ceaselessly to erect the most splendid of mortal accomplishments. Almost they reach to my domain, Mishim called. One wonders if you are trying to obtain it. Never, great celestial one. My domain is this land, and the sky is yours.
Wit thrust his hand high in his smoke, drawing the line of white into the shape of a straight pillar. His other hand swirled a pocket of green above it, like a whirlpool, a tower and a moon. That can't be natural, can it? Shallan thought. Is he light-weaving? yet she saw no stormlight. There was something more organic about what he did. She couldn't be completely certain it was supernatural. As always, Mishim was hatching a scheme. She loathed being hung in the sky each night, far from the delights of the world below and the pleasures that only mortals know. The next night, Mishim again passed Queen Tsai in her tower. "It is a pity," Mishim said, "that you cannot see the constellations from up close, for they are truly beautiful gemstones, shaped by the finest of gem cutters." "It is a pity," Sa said, "but all know that the eyes of a mortal would burn to see such a lofty sight." On the next night, Mishim tried again. "It is a pity," she said, "that you cannot converse with the star spren as they tell delightsome stories." "It is a pity," Sa agreed, "but everyone knows that the language of the heavens would drive a mortal mad." The next night, Mishim tried a third time. "It is a pity that you cannot see the beauty of your kingdom from above, for the pillars and domes of your city are radiant." "It is a pity," Sa agreed, "but those sights are meant for the great ones of heaven, and to behold them myself would be blasphemous." Wit dropped another powder into the brazier, bringing up yellow gold smoke. By now, dozens of people had gathered to watch. He swept his hands to the sides, sending the smoke spraying out in a flat plain. Then it crept upward again in lines, forming towers. A city? He continued to swirl with one hand, drawing the green smoke up into a ring that, with a thrust of his hand, he sent spinning across the top of the yellow golden city. It was remarkable, and Shallan found her jaw dropping. This was an image that lived. Wit glanced to the side where he'd put his pack. He started, as if surprised. Shallan cocked her head as he quickly recovered, jumping back into the story so fast that it was easy to miss his lapse. But now, as he spoke, he searched the audience with careful eyes. "Mishim," he said, "was not finished. The queen was pious, but the moon was crafty. I will leave it to you to decide which is the more powerful." The fourth night, as Mishim passed the queen, she tried a different ploy. "Yes," Mishim said, "your city is grand, as only a god can see from above. That is why it is so sad that one of the towers has a flawed roof." Wit swept to the side, destroying the lines of smoke that made up the city. He let the smoke dwindle, the powders he'd thrown running out, all save the line of green. "What?" Sa said. "A flawed tower? Which one?" "It is but a minor blemish," Mishim said. "Do not let it worry you. I appreciate the effort your craftsmen, however incompetent, put into their work." She continued on her way, but knew that she had trapped the queen. Indeed, on the next night, the beautiful queen stood waiting on her balcony. "Great one of the heavens," Sa called, "we have inspected the roofs and cannot find the imperfection. Please, please tell me which tower it is, so I can break it down."
"I cannot say," Mishim said. "To be mortal is to be flawed. It is not right to expect perfection of you." This only made the queen more worried. On the next night, she asked, "Great one of the sky, is there a way that I could visit the heavens? I will close my ears to the stories of the star spren and turn my eyes away from the constellations. I would look only upon the flawed works of my people, not the sights meant for you, so that I may see with my own eyes what must be fixed."
"It is a forbidden thing that you ask," Mishim said,
"for we would have to trade places and hope that Noman does not notice."
She said it with much glee, though hidden, for this request was the very thing she desired.
"I will feign that I am you," Tsa promised, "and I will do all that you do. We will switch back once I am done, and Noman will never know."
Wit grinned broadly. "And so?"
The moon and the woman traded places.
His raw enthusiasm for the story was infectious, and Shallan found herself smiling. They were at war, the city was falling, but all she wanted to do was listen to the end of this story. Wit used powders to send up 4 different smoke lines, blue, yellow, green, and intense orange. He swirled them together in a transfixing vortex of hues. And as he worked, his blue eyes fell on Shallan. They narrowed, and his smile became sly.
"He just recognized me," she realized. "I'm still wearing Vale's face. But how? How did he know?"
When he finished his swirling colors, the moon had become white, and the single straight tower he made by swiping up in the smoke was instead pale green.
"Mishim came down among the mortals," he proclaimed, "and Saa climbed the heavens to sit in the place of the moon. Mishim spent the remaining hours of the night drinking and courting and dancing and singing and doing all the things she had watched from afar. She lived frantically during her few hours of freedom. In fact, she was so captivated that she forgot to return, and was shocked by the dawning of sunlight. She hurriedly climbed to the queen's high tower, but Saa had already set, and the night had passed. Mishim now knew not only the delights of mortality, but the anxiety as well. She passed the day in great disquiet, knowing that Saa would be trapped with her wise sister and solemn brother, spending the day in the place where moons rest. When night again came, Mishim hid inside the tower, expecting that Salus would call out and chide her for her appetites. Yet Salus passed without comment. Surely when Noman rose, he would lash out against her foolishness. Yet Noman passed without comment. Finally, Saa rose in the sky, and Mishim called to her. "Queen Saa, mortal, what has happened? My siblings did not call to me. Did you somehow go undiscovered?"
"No," Saa replied. "Your siblings knew me as an impostor immediately."
"Then let us trade places quickly," Mishim said, "so that I may tell them lies and placate them."
"They are placated already," Saa said. "They think I am delightful. We spent the daylight hours feasting."
"Feasting?" Her siblings had never feasted with her before.
"We sang sweet songs together."
"Songs?" Her siblings had never sung with her before.
"It is truly wonderful up here," Saa said. "The star-spren tell amazing tales, as you promised, and the gemstone constellations are grand from up close."
"Yes, I love those stories and those sights."
"I think," Saa said, "that I might stay."
Wit let the smoke fail until only a single line of green remained. It shrank down, dwindling, almost out. When he spoke, his voice was soft.
"Mishim," he said, "now knew another mortal emotion, loss." The moon began to panic. She thought of her grand view from up so high, where she could see all lands and enjoy, if from afar, their art, buildings, and songs. She remembered the kindness of Noman and the thoughtfulness of Salus. Wit made a swirl of white smoke and pushed it slowly to his left, the new moon Saa close to setting.
"Wait," Mishim said. "Wait, Saa. Your word is broken. You spoke to the Starspren and gazed upon the constellations."
Wit caught the smoke ring with one hand, somehow making it stay, swirling in one place.
"Noman said that I could," Saa explained, "and I was not harmed." "You broke your word nonetheless," Mishim cried. "You must come back to Earth, mortal, for our bargain is at an end."
Wit let the ring hang there, then vanish. To Mishim's eternal relief, Saa relented. The queen climbed back down into her tower, and Mishim scrambled up into the heavens. With great pleasure, she sank toward the horizon. Though just before she set, Mishim heard a song. Oddly, Wit added a small line of blue smoke to the brazier. It was a song of laughter, of beauty, a song Mishim had never heard. It took her long to understand that song, until months later she passed in the sky at night and saw the queen in the tower again, holding a child with skin that was faintly blue. They did not speak, but Mishim knew. The queen had tricked her. Sa had wanted to spend one day in the heavens to know Noman for a night. She had given birth to a son with pale blue skin, the color of Noman himself, a son born of the gods who would lead her people to glory, a son who bore the mantle of the heavens. And that is why to this day the people of Natanatan have skin of a faintly blue shade, and it is why Mishim, though still crafty, has never again left her place. Most importantly, it is the story of how the moon came to know the one thing that before only mortals had known. Loss. The last line of blue smoke dwindled, then went out. Wit didn't bow for applause or ask for tips. He sat back down on the cistern wall that had been his stage, looking exhausted. People waited, stunned, until a few started yelling for more. Wit remained silent. He bore their requests, their pleas, then their curses. Slowly, the audience drifted away. Eventually, only Shallan stood before him. Wit smiled at her. "Why that story?" she asked. "Why now?" "I don't give the meanings, child," he said. "You should know that by now. I just tell the tale."
"It was beautiful."
"Yes," he said. Then he added, "I miss my flute."
"Your what?"
He hopped up and began gathering his things. Shallan slipped forward and glanced inside his pack, catching sight of a small jar, sealed at the top. It was mostly black, but the side pointed toward her was instead white. Wit snapped the pack closed. "Come. You look like you could use the opportunity to buy me something to eat.